Welcome to the Theopolis Podcast. I'm Peter Leithart, and I'm here today with Alistair Roberts and Jeff Myers. James Bijan, who is a regular with us, is not able to be with us today. We look forward to him returning and continuing to help us think through the book of Deuteronomy, which is the subject of our current series. Thanks to Brian Motes, who is, as usual, recording and making sure everybody sounds good and making sure that everything, that this episode of the podcast gets out to the public. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your joining us and pray that it's useful and helpful to you. Pray, too, that you're enjoying the Lord's blessings as we go through the Lenten season, as we approach Holy Week, and as we come to the celebration of Jesus' resurrection at Easter. We pray that the Lord abundantly blesses you. We're in the middle of a section of Deuteronomy that deals with the eighth word, that is, thou shalt not steal. We're right at the end of Deuteronomy 23. We'll be starting with verse 21 today, and then working our way through the end of the chapter, perhaps getting into chapter 24 a little bit. But to begin, I want to reflect a little bit on the idea of law. We talked about this before. I think we talked about it right at the beginning of our series on Deuteronomy, and the way that the biblical idea of Torah differs from our contemporary ideas of law and what law looks like. Modern law codes strive to be precise. They have to have precise definition of terms, precise definitions of cases and situations. They seek to be systematic, logical. Certain kinds of law codes are grounded on fundamental principles that are then worked out with a kind of logic into a system. Law codes are intended to be comprehensive. They're supposed to cover a large number of cases. Can't cover every possible case, of course, but enough cases and specifics to give the logic for what should be worked out and when you apply the law to new situations. We've just been having this discussion in my home state of Alabama currently. The Supreme Court recently came down with a decision regarding that touches on in vitro fertilization. There were embryos, frozen embryos, that were destroyed in a couple of different clinics. And so people sued the clinics because the embryos were the property. They were the fertilized embryos, you could say the children of the people who had provided the egg and the sperm to fertilize the embryos. And the in vitro fertilization clinics did not provide sufficient protections. And the Alabama Supreme Court applied an old statute that has to do with the unintentional killing of minors to the situation of in vitro fertilization, because the state of Alabama had no legislation covering in vitro fertilization per se. And so they're taking the principles from that older, you know, quite old statute and trying to apply it to a situation. And they found that frozen embryos should be treated as persons, should be protected, legally protected. So that's the way legal reasoning works in the modern world. You have can't cover everything, but you have a certain logic and you try to apply logically to similar cases, comparing similar to similar. But there's this expectation that the law is going to be fairly comprehensive and systematic. And that law and morality are kept distinct. You don't have, sometimes intention will play a role in, you know, for example, whether a case of killing is manslaughter or murder. Sometimes emotions will come into play in certain kinds of cases. But the law tends to be dispassionate and tries to exclude those kinds of considerations and apply to actions and the consequences of actions. And in the light of that, Torah functions differently. It's not, first of all, it's not comprehensive. There are all kinds of things that the law doesn't talk about that we wish it did. If we get to chapter 24, we'll be looking at one of these. The one divorce law in the Torah is at the beginning of Deuteronomy 24, and it gives a very brief and vague description of the cause of divorce. And it doesn't necessarily prove the cause. It just says, if a man finds this and divorces his wife, then this is what happens. It doesn't, maybe it's setting some kind of norm for how divorces should proceed. And maybe it's setting some kind of standard about justifiable causes for divorce, but that's not obvious in the way that the law is given. And this is the only overt law in the entire Pentateuch that covers divorce. And so, you know, it's a case where we wish, you know, if you had a modern law code, family court, family law, it would have a much more detailed, specific description of what is justifiable divorce, what the procedures are, what the consequences are, and so on and so forth. But the Torah is not comprehensive in that way. And the Torah also includes things that we expect not in law codes, but in sermons. So there are warnings and there are promises. We looked at this in the last episode. If you don't charge interest to your brother, then the Lord will bless you in all that you undertake in the land where you're about to enter to possess. So you do it in order to be blessed by the Lord. If you abuse your workers, then your workers might cry out to the Lord and the Lord will hear them, and you might be cursed because you have abused your workers. If you treat somebody who's your debtor with dignity and you treat them properly according to the law, then they will bless you. There's all kind of motivation clauses and exhortations that are included in the law that are really more sermonic than what we think of as legal. And particularly in Deuteronomy, that's the case, where Moses is literally giving a series of sermons on the 10 words and is including exhortations of that sort along the way. So with that reminder, we're going to start at Deuteronomy 23:21, which is a law concerning vows. When you make a vow to Yahweh your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for it would be sin in you. Vows and oaths are somewhat distinct. Vows are promises. If you make a vow to Yahweh, then you're promising to do something on the condition that God performs something for you. So this is what Jacob does, for example, when he goes out of the land and he heads toward Haran. He's alone. He has nothing but his staff. And he vows, if you, Lord, keep me through this journey. I don't remember what he promises to give, but he promises to give some return if the Lord preserves him and prospers him in his exile. But it's a promise that's made on condition that the Lord does something. It's a promise in view of future repayment, some kind of future debt that you're going to repay to the Lord. That's different from an oath, which in the Bible tend to be self-maledictory promises. An oath, you promise to do something on pain of death and curses. You know, the Lord do so to me and more also if I don't accomplish this. May the Lord curse me. May the Lord bring the covenant, curses of the covenant upon me if I don't perform the law that he's commanded. So oaths don't have the same kind of conditionality, but vows tend to have this kind of condition. So paying a votive offering means that you have vowed to do something and you will offer something to the Lord if X or Y happens. And when it does happen, then you offer your votive offerings. And the simple law here is that if you make such a vow, make such a promise to the Lord, then you should settle it. You shouldn't delay in keeping your vows.
One thing this should remind us of is the power of words and the importance of words. So, for example, I have had not a few people tell me after marriage, years after marriage, sometimes only a few years after marriage vows, that, oh, those were just words. Yeah, I said some things there, but now that, you know, the situation has changed, whatever that might be, I'm not bound to that. I'm like, well, wait a minute, you made vows before the Lord. Now we could argue about whether marriage vows should be taken in church and before the Lord or not, but I do think that I do think it's important to solemnize marriage vows in church. But here, what's surprising to me is, oh, those are just words. Well, they're not words, and it's a fearful thing to think that they were just words because you invoked the Lord's name, and now you're just abandoning it and thinking you're going to get away with it. I don't think people will get away with it unless there's a legitimate reason for not fulfilling the vow.
Yeah, and the language of verse 23 enforces that pretty strongly. It uses the verb shamar, to guard, and the verb to do, asa. So guard and do what goes from your lips. which is the very same language that Moses has been using throughout Deuteronomy about Yahweh's words, going back at least to Deuteronomy 6. You guard and do everything that comes from the Lord's mouth. And now, when something goes from your mouth, a promise goes from your mouth before the Lord, and you make a vow to the Lord, that becomes like a divine imperative to you that you have to guard and do. It has the same force that Yahweh's own words, because you've committed yourself in the name of the Lord.
We might think here of Jephthah's vow, or the rash vow of Saul, which sets him against Jonathan on account of his curse upon the person who eats before the victory. Might also think of the words of Peter to Ananias and Sapphira in Acts concerning their sin, that while the property was still in their possession and they had not vowed anything, it remained in their possession. There was no obligation for them to give the proceeds of the land. But once they had made the vow, they were lying to the Holy Spirit when they did not actually deliver the full amount. And so taking those words is not required of you. It's not necessary that you make the vow, but if you make the vow, it is something that you are bound by, even potentially at great expense to yourself, as in the case of Jephthah or Saul or Ananias and Sapphira.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's the one of the marks of the righteous man, Psalm 15, who shall ascend the mountain of the Lord, shall stand in his holy place. It includes somebody who doesn't lend out his money at interest, but also includes somebody who keeps his vow even to his own hurt. So somebody, even at great cost, guards and keeps the words that come out of his mouth. I think your other comment, Alistair, kind of maybe gets to the question of why this is included in the under the eighth word. How does this cover some form of theft? And the Ananias and Sapphira incident may be a case of this. Probably other ways to think about it, but one of the ways that I thought about this as a case of theft would be, I promise something to the Lord on condition that this happens. If the Lord does it, if I keep back what I vowed, as Ananias and Sapphira do, then I'm taking something from the Lord. I'm stealing from him, as it were. And that means that at the moment that I make my vow, that item that I vowed has become his. It's a kind of a speech act that transfers the ownership of the thing vowed to the Lord in the act of vowing, as it were. And so then eventually keeping it back will be a theft.
You have so many examples of this in Scripture too. And some of them there are not just about the person who made the vow forgetting it or not fulfilling it, but even through generations. I'm thinking of 2 Samuel 21, where Saul apparently just, you know, doesn't care that Joshua made a vow to the Lord about the Gibeonites. And that, as a result of him not honoring the vow that Joshua made to the Gibeonites, he plunges the land into famine and in all sorts of trouble. So that it's not just us honoring our own vows, it's also us paying attention to vows that other people make about others that we have to deal with, or something like that at least.
That's an interesting case, because you know that obviously Joshua was tricked into making that promise and entering into that covenant, and yet honors it.
Clearly, vows and oaths were an important issue at the time of the Reformation. Maybe dealing with the Anabaptist or Radical Reformation and some of their approaches to vows, and also to the vows made by people in religious orders. What are we to make of the requirements in Jesus' teaching in Matthew 5 in the Sermon on the Mount? Do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. Not quite the same as vows, but it seems to be related. And certainly within the history of Protestantism, questions of vows and oaths have been quite freighted with concerns about heresies on either side. How are we supposed to handle these issues within the new covenant? Should we still be taking vows?
One thing that stands out to me in relation to that question, Alistair, is that we do have Paul taking a vow. So whatever Jesus meant by that, and maybe this was just one of these kind of exaggerated statements for effect, possibly, or maybe it relates in somehow contextually to what was going on in Israel at the time. You could add to that the statement in James 5, too. There's a statement in there about not making any vows as well. Do not swear by heaven or earth or any other oath. Let your yes be yes and your no be no, or you may fall under condemnation. Again, I think that has to do with the kinds of angry vows that are coming out of the anger and frustration with the persecuted church. But at the same time, it's rather, it doesn't admit of any qualifications if you just lift that verse out and make it stand on its own. And yet there are other times when Christians are taking oaths in the New Testament. They are taking vows. And so somehow there's got to be a way to, a good way to reconcile that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that, just on the surface of those gospel texts, one of the things Jesus is dealing with is a kind of subterfuge where if you don't actually use the name of the Lord, but swear by something else, then you have a little wiggle room to get out of it. I didn't swear by the Lord's name. I swore by the temple. Jesus rules that kind of subterfuge out. I don't know the Jewish literature to know if there's evidence that kind of subterfuge was used, but that's one of the things he's addressing at the outset. And I think that, one of the ways it's been interpreted in kind of the magisterial mainstream Protestant tradition over it against Anabaptists who rule out oaths and vows entirely is that it partly applies to kind of everyday speech. There are formal occasions when you take oaths, in the courtroom, as the example of Paul that Jeff pointed out. You take a vow, Paul takes a vow. Paul also is in courtrooms where he's put under oath. Jesus is put under oath. I adjure you by the living God in his trial. So there are formal settings where there's appropriateness to heightening language and to reinforcing the truth of what you say. But the normal everyday course of things, you should speak straightforwardly without having to reinforce it with various kinds of oaths and swearing and calling on God as witness. Your words should be trustworthy enough that you don't need those apparatus to win people's trust.
And in terms of vows of celibacy, of obedience, of poverty, those would also seem to be important issues dividing from Rome, the sort of religious orders that existed, and also from certain forms of Anabaptism, which had their own principles of communal living or poverty or requirements of members that would seem to maybe encourage a sense of supererogation or a sense of the onus of taking such vows, undermining the sort of freedom that people should enjoy in the gospel, and certain vows being fundamentally compromising. So I wonder how we're supposed to handle vows more broadly. Should we be making vows for religious orders? Should there be vows of celibacy or vows of communal living in certain extreme contexts? Or are these things that we should just generally eschew?
As you mentioned before, Alistair, especially during Reformation and post-Reformation, a huge issue. So chapter 22 in the Westminster Confession of Faith is a long chapter, seven paragraphs, and starts with, the first words are, a lawful oath, okay? And so I think that's where most of the Reformation kind of landed on, a lawful oath. And there are such things as unlawful oaths, like an oath of, you know, perpetual celibacy, or taking an oath to do something that's forbidden in Scripture, or to not do something that's enjoined in Scripture. I think that chapter in the Westminster Confession is a pretty good one, and helps us understand when oaths and vows are appropriate and when they're not.
Yeah, and I return to what I said at the beginning of the discussion, that vows have a built-in terminus, typically, in the way that the Bible uses the different terms. If you take a vow, there's going to be a point at which something has or has not happened, and then you pay what you promised to the Lord at that point. As, again, Jacob is a kind of paradigm case. I think it's the first time the language of vowing is used in the Bible. He's asking the Lord to bring him back to the land and keeping him, and then he'll return. It's returned some, I don't know, is it a tithe? I don't remember the specifics. But there's a terminus to that. If the Lord does bring him back, then the vow has to be paid and completed. A Nazarite vow would typically be a similar thing. There are a handful of lifetime Nazarites in the Bible, but mostly it's a vow for a period of time after which you fulfill the vow and complete it.
Yeah, and those are the vows that Paul takes outside of the courtroom. And he has also, when he gets to Jerusalem, he has four men with him as well, apparently Christian men who've also taken the same vow, and they're going to complete it at the temple.
One detail about the language here I think is interesting and worth noting. The word for pay in verse 21 is shalom, which you can tell from the sound, even if you don't know any Hebrew, it's related to a word for peace, shalom, which everybody knows that as a greeting and as a vision of plenty and of harmony. But paying a vow is a kind of restoration of harmony and restoration of peace. Shalom comes up in other kinds of contexts. Sometimes it's used in context of penalties. The person who has done something wrong has to pay, and the enforcement of the penalty brings a condition of shalom. It shaloms the situation. And that seems to be what's going on here, that you make a vow to do something, make a vow to offer something to the Lord, to do some service to the Lord. That's an outstanding debt, as it were, that is resolved, and there's a kind of return to normalcy, a return to the previous kind of relation you had when the vow is complete, when you paid what you promised. The last couple of verses of chapter 23 go on to a different topic, which is scrumping. That's the word that's used for this kind of, not harvest, but eating from a field, eating from a vineyard, as the presumption is somebody's traveling, they get hungry, they're wandering by a vineyard, and they're allowed to pick grapes until they're satisfied and their hunger goes away. They're allowed to go into standing grain, as the disciples do in the Gospels, and pluck the grain and eat from it. And that practice is called scrumping. And there's a couple of dimensions to this in Deuteronomy. It's not really a permission given for scrumping. It's an assumption that scrumping is permitted. When you enter your neighbor's vineyard, then you may eat grapes until you're satisfied. So there's a presumed privilege of doing this, and also a presumed permission on the part of the landowner to allow it to happen, and then a restriction on that permission. You go into your neighbor's vineyard to eat some grapes and to satisfy your hunger. That doesn't mean the vineyard now becomes communal property and you're allowed to go and harvest part of his vineyard or harvest part of his grain. So you can't take a basket and fill up the basket. You can't take a sickle and start harvesting your neighbor's grain crop, but you're allowed to take enough to satisfy your hunger so you can continue traveling. Perhaps this is also provision, like the gleaning provision for landless poor people who don't have anything. And if they haven't had a meal for the day, they can go to the nearest vineyard and they can eat part of the fruit of the vineyard to satisfy their hunger.
Yeah, this is not the same thing, as you mentioned, this is as gleaning. This is something a little different. You could, in fact, after the harvest or during the harvest, as in the story of Ruth, you can collect, you can actually collect the grain and take it home, or I'm assuming also grapes, although I don't know if we have an example of that. The other thing I notice here is that there is no judgment, no warning attached to this. A warning is not maybe the best word. No consequence listed. In all these other laws so far, you have, you know, the Lord your God will judge you, payment, you know, you want to be blessed by God, be careful, you know, over and over again, including the next one in Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. There's nothing here at all. And I just wonder about that. Perhaps it has to do, I don't know, with the nature of the crime, if you will, nature of the violation of the law. It's maybe not as serious as others if you actually do this. I don't know. I just throw that out and just curious that there's ordinarily some rationale, some warning at the end of these laws, and there's nothing here.
Yeah, my inclination would be to take other similar rules that, I don't think you have any enforcement or exhortation that's, actually you do in the gleaning laws, 24:19, for the alien, orphan, widow, that the Lord may bless you. I guess my inclination would be that to just transfer those same exhortations here, and that it may not be civil enforcement, but if a landowner chases somebody away from his vineyard who's just trying to take a few grapes so that they have a meal for the day, or a traveler passing through tries to chase them off, then that person might cry out to the Lord and the Lord will hear. My inclination would be that the same kind of logic applies. I do think it's interesting that what this suggests about what property rights mean for ancient Israel. On the one hand, it's, as I already said, it's not communal property. You don't have a landowner who is raising the, has a vineyard that he's cultivated and taken care of, maybe a vineyard that's been taken care of for generations in his family. Grain, he's expended put in the seed. He's expended the work to maintain the grain field. He's maintaining the entire property. You can't just walk in and take the fruit of his labor and treat his vineyard or his grain field as if it were your own. So it's not communal property, but at the same time, it's not exactly private property in the sense that we think of it. I think the background principle is that this field belongs to Yahweh. This field is loaned, as it were, to the owner who sojourns on it. And that sojourner has to use it in the way that the landowner, Yahweh, demands. And that use of his property includes making part of the fruit, part of the produce of his property available to other people, and not to just maximize the profit from it, and not to set up barriers that keep other people off his property and prevent anyone else from benefiting from his property. So there's this, property rights are typically rights of exclusion, that you know, if you own a piece of property, then you have the right to chase people off of the property. And that's certainly true that there's a right of exclusion here. And I would guess, as we've talked about in the last episode, that would be applicable in the gleaning laws too. There's a right of exclusion, but it's a modified or qualified right of exclusion that means that the property is not only for the benefit of the property owner, and you know, the property owner is going to bless the community by selling his produce, but it's also his property is for the benefit of passing travelers. His property is for the benefit of the poor. So there's a communal dimension to the use of his personal property that makes it a kind of qualified private property principle.
There's certainly, for instance, the presumption of right of way. We can think of Jesus going through the standing grain with his disciples. We presume not just that they are able to eat some of the grain, but that they are able to walk through such a field within reason. Presumably, there would be restrictions upon just treating such a field as a thoroughfare, but you need to be able to walk from A to B, and having paths through people's property is reasonable and should be expected.
spoken like an Englishman. Yeah, I mean that's part of the English tradition, right? To have right of ways through privately owned property.
It certainly is something that has been pushed for historically, and we now have. It's weakened in various ways, but yes, it's an important principle. And I think these debates are debates behind, we mentioned the Westminster Confession, but the Westminster Larger Catechism talks about enclosures, unlawful enclosures. And I think that's getting at some of what this passage treats.
But this passage is not so much about someone having a legal claim on your property as much as on the fruit of your labor. Right. So this is not about so much about boundaries as it is about, look, you've labored, you've prepared something, you've worked at this. Now there's fruit, there's grapes, and there's grain. And that doesn't belong exclusively to you. You, and in fact, it's almost like you must recognize that other people have a claim on at least part of the fruit of your labor, and you need to be open to that.
Yeah, that's a good distinction, Jeff. That what they're taking is they're not occupying a corner of the vineyard and making their home there. That's right. The land is the landowner's. What I'm thinking of is that you have, let's say you've got a fenced piece of property where you're growing grain or some way of marking it off. Somebody comes in to enjoy the fruit of that. The Lord prohibits you from chasing them off. If they bring a sickle, you can chase them away. If they come in to satisfy their immediate hunger, then you can't. Same with the gleaning. Again, even if presumably there is some sort of screening, it means that the people can come on your property that the Lord is requiring. The owner of the land, the ultimate owner of the land, is requiring that. And as you say, certainly the fruit of the property is not just for the landowner. I think that it seems to me that we talked about Ananias and Sapphira in the last episode, I think, but it seems to me that the similar kind of principle that you find in the early church. On the one hand, Peter says, you know, Ananias and Sapphira, the property is yours to decide what to do with what you will. But the overriding impulse and expectation is that people who own property recognize that it's not just for their own benefit and the benefit of their families. It is that, but it's also to be used for the benefit of the community of the church. And if there's a great need in the church, then a sacrificing your own property for the sake of that need, that's the picture that we have. But it seems to have the same kind of principle where you have what belongs to you is ultimately the Lord's. And so it's for yourself and for your own, your family, but it's also there to serve the needs of the people of God.
And there, I think it's interesting that it's in the context of the Feast of Weeks or Feast of Pentecost that the law concerning gleaning is given in Leviticus 23, the fulfillment of the principle of Pentecost, which is in part the recognition of entrance into the land and of liberation. You can think about the parallels between Sinai and the Lord's appearance there in the context of the Feast of Pentecost and the events of Jericho as the seven blasts of the trumpet declare the sort of jubilee principle of the land returning to its proper owners. The Feast of Pentecost or weeks is jubilee in miniature. And part of the fulfillment of that is that everyone has some share in the harvest. And the fact that the early church does not have people who are cut out or in great need, but everyone's providing for each other, is a fulfillment of the fundamental Pentecost principle that we already have introduced in Leviticus 23.
I guess I'm going to ask the question, how we can understand how this is applied literally in an agricultural kind of situation, culture. But how does this apply today? What does this mean for us? So the fruit of our labors not just belong to us to do with it or to restrict others from benefiting from it. But in this, you know, does this mean that obviously this doesn't mean that a shop owner, so someone owns a shop and or owns a market or something and has all this fruit and stuff, it doesn't mean that people can just walk through the market, pick up what they want and eat it, or does it? So how does this work itself out? You know, Christian is conscious of the fact that, the Lord owns everything. He's given us everything we've produced. He's allowed us to be productive and to create things or whatever that might be. So how does this work itself out then in practical ways in the modern world?
In response to the particular scenario you offered, I think you're right. And I think that would have been the, as far as, you know, somebody has harvested their grapes and they've gone to the village market and they're selling their grapes in the marketplace in the village. Can somebody just walk by if they're hungry and start eating it? I'm guessing that that's not the case. It's the vineyard itself, and maybe there's a principle in the background that whatever they're eating is reproducible. They're eating the grapes from the vine, but the vine is going to produce more grapes. Once harvest is done, the laws of the harvest have to do with gleaning, and you glean what's left over, not what's been harvested and taken by the owner. So I think it seems like there would be a distinction even in ancient Israel between eating something that's growing in the field or growing in the vineyard and taking it from the shop. And I guess as far as the principle to repeat, I guess, is what I think you find in both the Old and New Testament seems to be that you have property, you have a business, you have productive property of any sort that is for the profit and the benefit and the fruitfulness and the wealth of your family and those who are owners. That's true. But at the same time, it's not, as you said, Jeff, it's not exclusively yours, and the fruit of that labor is not exclusively yours. And finding ways to direct the produce of your business or your land to the hungry or to the poor, I think that's more complicated depending on the kind of business that it is. But it needs to be, you need to have not just the consciousness that your property is given to you by God for the benefit of the people of God, but actual practices that do that, whatever those practices might be.
Yeah, I suppose that it's easier to apply in a more direct way the gleaning kind of principle, that what's left over after your harvest, you should be generous with those. You know, we can apply that in all sorts of ways with businesses, who, especially grocery stores and restaurants and things. There ought to be a appreciation for the fact that it always amazes me that I talk to people that work at Costco or work at Walmart or work in a restaurant, and the amount of food that's thrown away is shocking. Surely there's some way in a Christian culture for us to give that to people that need it. I mean, of course, there's in Western cultures, there's not a lot of poverty, not a lot of starvation, but still, I can see how the gleaning laws could be applied to the modern world. I was just wondering about this, and perhaps it's the principle that we need to keep in mind, that then is also extended, that principle is extended and applied to gleaning as well.
One thing about gleaning is that the person is not, the gleaner is not just receiving some handout. They're participating in some of the fruits of your labor, and those fruits are actual fruits. They're not just something that's pure exchange value like cash. When we think about the ways in which we might fulfill this principle, I wonder whether it requires a certain degree of creativity and imagination of us. And so in my own work, I think I've always found it helpful to think of ways that my regular vocation can be something that people can draw upon without having first had a claim through some financial or transactional contract. And so there will be many occasions when I'm just visiting an area and there is someone there in the church who asks me to speak for them, and not asking for any sort of payment in those sorts of situations. And situations where someone wants me to write for them or something, and they don't necessarily have money to pay for it, answering yes to many of those inquiries and requests is one of the ways that I feel I can perform the law of gleaning, where my actual labor is something that people can draw upon, not just my money, but the actual things that I'm doing. And they can make claims that make me responsible to perform acts for them. And my work then becomes seen as something different. It's not just for my own sake. It's for the building up of all.
Yeah, that's really helpful, Alistair. I think a lot of pastors listening to this podcast can relate to that too. I probably haven't thought of it in connection with gleaning and this grumping, but hey, I do the same thing. And in fact, especially as pastors, we're often providing our services to people without any expectation of a return, at least not a monetary return. We expect, of course, a relationship and friendship and deepening kinds of love for one another, but nothing like... that reminds me, in thinking about this particular law, is what would be the interpersonal kind of... what would be the result of this between owners and people that are traveling or people that are in poverty? I think that goes unnoticed here, is that this would tend to bind people together. So instead of an owner coming out and you know, with his shotgun, you know, warning people off of his vineyard, he'd come out maybe and meet the person just to make sure, on the one hand, to make sure they weren't, you know, carrying a basket and, you know, actually harvesting his grapes. But on the other hand, to just interact with him. Okay, who is this guy? Who is his family? Where are they going? What's going on? And perhaps that is also part of the result, part of the effects of this kind, these kinds of laws.
Yeah, I think that your example, Jeff, I think gives an example where there's an opportunity for kind of some kind of scrumping like behavior or practice. You have a grocery store; they have things that they need to throw out because they're a day old. Have a restaurant who prepares food that they don't sell that evening. I know that there are ministries that collect discarded food like that and make it available. But you know, if you own a restaurant or a grocery store, you could do that yourself. And you know, you after all the patrons have been fed, you've got a 10 o'clock not a seating, but a 10 o'clock offering of whatever leftover food there is, first come, first served. And you make takeaway boxes for people who want to come and eat the excess of what you produced for that evening.
One thing about that, Peter, and that doesn't need to be a handout. You could just charge something, you know, a third of the price you ordinarily charge, so that people aren't just getting a handout. They're actually contributing something towards.
Right. And that would screen out people who are just going to abuse the system and you know, capitalize on free things, which is, you know, what every charity has to face. I want to kind of conclude here with a theological point. I think it's, you know, obviously when we see grapes and then grain in the succession of two verses, then we think, uh-oh, we're in a sacramental territory. I think that there's a kind of temple liturgical context given by the picture of somebody entering into the vineyard and entering into the standing grain. The language is language that's used for coming into the house of the Lord or coming into the courtyard to offer a sacrifice, coming into the courts of the Lord in order to enjoy his bounty. And one implication of that is that this is what the Lord does. The Lord permits us to come into his property, eat the produce, the fruit that he provides. I mean, he's the source of every good and perfect gift. He provides the fruit, and he opens his vineyard and he opens his grain field and lets us eat the bread and the wine. Israel has been given the land from the Lord, full of vineyards, full of fields. It's a good land, and they're enjoying that bounty. And so they should extend that bounty to the hungry that are in the land. So it's as often in Deuteronomy and throughout the Torah, the principle is that Israel is being conformed to the character of Yahweh. This is a kind of imitation of God that's at the center of Israel's life, both individual landowners and corporately. This is what should characterize Israel. They should be a Yahweh-like people.
Wasn't going to bring it up in response to that, but I was wondering whether there is a connection between the discussion in Mark and Matthew about the disciples scrumping as they're going through on the Sabbath. And was David and his men, should that be seen as a case of scrumping?
Right. Well, that's the way that Jesus takes it when he makes the comparison between David on the Sabbath taking the showbread that's being changed out and the disciples on the Sabbath eating grain, which, yeah, that's a good point. That would reinforce the connection between scrumping from a field and scrumping from the tabernacle.
Thank you again for enjoying this episode of the Theopolis Podcast. For more information and for more content from Theopolis, you can check us out online at theopolisinstitute.com. We release new articles every Tuesday and Thursday on our blog, so you'll want to make sure to look out for those. You can also find us on Twitter at @_Theopolis and on Facebook if you just search for our name. If you've been helped, sharpened, and encouraged by this podcast, we'd really love it if you would go to iTunes and leave us a review. It just takes a few seconds, and it really will help us along in getting our content in front of new listeners. That's all for now, friends. We really look forward to being with you all again in the next episode. And as always, thank you so much for listening.